I suppose the best idea, Finn, would be for me to relate, first of all, to the subtitle that I have, the Arrow Aircraft.
Oh, yes.
And now, and to the Harkness Papers and that sort of thing. So I'll, when I read this thing back, this recording that we're having, I'll be able to refer also to the current.
Yes.
So, and this is, it'll probably take more than one session of Starlight Review.
Oh, yes.
We can possibly do an hour this afternoon, mm-hmm. an hour next week or something. Mm-hmm. This is a letter to Mr. David Audley of Edmonton, Alberta. From Harkness. And he says, with reference to your comments concerning the Avro aircraft CF-105, I can assure you that the government carefully examined and re-examined the need for this aircraft before it was finally decided to cancel the contract. A thorough examination was made in the light of all the information available concerning the probable nature of the threats to the North American continent in future years, the alternative means of defense against this threat, and the estimated cost of providing such a defense. The very painful decision which was arrived at by the government was that the development of this aircraft should be terminated. He goes on to say that a major reason was the enormous expense. And he adds that it must be realized that one of the most difficult problems facing those who are in charge of our defense programs that they must prepare to meet the present threat as well as any plans for future threats. Now, of course, this is only one of the cards on the Arrow aircraft, mm-hmm. but I was wondering if you had any comments on it, as you remember.
Yes, well, the decision had been made while Mr. Birx was in office. And announced. So really, Mr. Harkness was going into history. He had no part of it as a minister of national defense. Now I've forgotten what he was doing before, just at the moment. And he may have had something to do with it as part of a cabinet decision, but he certainly was not at any of the meetings. Mm-hmm. When I say meetings, I don't mean cabinet meetings. I was at two meetings with. Mr. Diefenbaker had with the Minister of National Defense, and the Chairman, Chief of Staff, and the Chief of Staff, and the head of the Defense Research Board. These were the meetings leading up to the decision to cancel the Arrow.
And he had that whole group in? I mean,
he hit twice.
Twice. That's quite an array of talent. I mean, when you get not only the...
It was unusual, perhaps, in a sense. I don't recall the Prime Minister bringing in the Chief of Staff in a meeting with himself as Prime Minister. Normally, the Chief of Staff, either all of them, or one or two of them, depending what the subject might be, were at the Cabinet Defense Committee. But at the Cabinet Defense Committee, of course, the Prime Minister was the chairman, but there were a number of other ministers on the committee. But this was a meeting with the Prime Minister. And I think he wanted to really go into the matter very thoroughly. Why he didn't do it at a meeting of the Cabinet Defense Committee, I don't know. But I don't recall, I could have forgotten, but I don't recall this coming up at the Cabinet Defense Committee meeting. Now, I may have forgotten it because it was obviously two long meetings with nothing else but the Arrow.
Yeah.
So, and certainly the decision was announced very shortly after the last meeting to cancel the Arrow.
I'd be right, I imagine, in assuming that three heads, as well as yourself, would go for the cancellation of it.
Yes, we did. But I don't think that any of the papers that I have read really expressed it in the way I understood it, and I would think that the Chief Air Staff would bear out my views because we chatted about it between the meetings. The problem that faced us was, should we go ahead with the Arrow on the condition that there would be no increase in the defense budget and all the costs of re-equipping with the Arrow or completing the engineering trials and all the trials that had to be made. And re-equipping would have to be done at the present level, at that level of the defense budget, which, if I remember, was about $1.625 billion. This is of that order of magnitude. Well, it was clearly impossible to do this without disbanding a great part of the force. Because the re-equipping program, the number that were called, number called for and so was quite considerable. There were the development costs, and of course there was always this will-o'-the-wisp that people talked about. They talked about it gaily until the chips were down, that of course if the United States buys it, they will pick up a share of the development cost and so on. The price for a large order will be very, very much less. But we had to face the probability that the Americans might not buy any at all, and that the prices would not be what we were told they would be. It's never been our experience. Companies seem always to give you information on the probable cost of something before it becomes a fixed price contract at a very, very much lower price than it finally comes out. And obviously there was no one in competition with them. So certainly I had the feeling that the amount they told us it would be per aircraft was probably, might even be a half of what it would ultimately turn out. So in light of this, we felt that this wasn't, it wasn't sensible to go on. Of course, this begs the question, why was the thing started?
Well, again, on the assumption plus hope, perhaps, that the Americans would. And this was going to be my next question, is that as the Arrow went along, and as the prices mentioned, and did you notice yourself, I know you can only speak personally, perhaps, did you notice any lessening of interest of the Americans as perhaps something else was coming up on their side of the border?
I couldn't answer this accurately. One would have to go into files. Because when you ask people, you're never asking, we're never asking the Secretary of Defense. You're talking to people, to friendly people. They say they like it and so. But even if the USAF had wanted it, they would have to be very cautious as to what they would say, because when they come to fund, as they use the term, fund something of this sort, their appropriations have to go through Congress, and it would not have been made in the United States. And there is undoubtedly a large lobby. It's one thing to buy, as they did. I think perhaps what gave us the hope, the time of Korea, Canada got quite a number of orders, Sorrel Industries and whatnot, for the 75 and 90 millimeter AKAC anti-aircraft guns. Not very much for the radar. They were, their electronic industries for somehow seemed to be able to hold on to the procurement, providing these things for the American Army. Now, whether this made us hopeful or not, I'm not too sure. But I think there was, in part, here are some of the factors I think that came into play in a thing like this. First of all, there's the pride in doing something Canadian, that we have know-how. And if you don't get into some of these things, you fall behind in industrial know-how. and you take a very, very long while to get away from the role of the primary producer, which Canada was always thought to be, the pure wood, draw water, providing of coal and iron ore and copper and nickel and this sort of thing, wheat, pulp. But and you can recall very well that after the war, many economists and business people, both in Canada and the United States, said Canada had over-capitalized, over-industrialized during the war, and that it would have to close down a lot of these factories and go back more into primary production because with the size of the country, so they couldn't support it. Well, C.D. Howe was one of these optimists, be damned if they'll go back, we'll carry on. And I think we were fairly successful. But there comes a point in the sophistication of equipment and the time of production that I find it hard to believe it would compete for a long number of years. That this might have been a first-class aircraft, yes. And I think even if we had given, the government had not put budgetary limitations on it, that by the time that that was produced, it would be well behind other aircraft in the United States. I know there's the sort of cliche that whenever an aircraft is put into service, it's obsolete.
Yeah.
Well, you can say that with anything, a car or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy one every second or so a year, obviously it's nearly obsolete when you bought it. They're not worn out. But it is so that you always have aircraft 10, 15, 20 years ahead in your drawing boards.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at the French supersonic transport jet. Look how long it's been under development. So
yeah.
I have a feeling that even if the money had gone into it, we might have equipped the air division with it once. Then there would have been tremendous pressure in the government to give some away in mutual aid to keep the factory going.
Mm-hmm.
Because that factory, there was a great hoo-ha losing all the techniques.
Yeah.
Of not only the designers, the skilled artisans, but if this had gone into production at any rate at all, think of the great number more of highly skilled workers that would have had to been trained and brought into the Toronto area. And then to have this all collapse would have been even worse. So I feel that there always was on the part of the military also the worry that when the balance of payments with the United States became difficult, if you tried to buy something American, the Minister of Finance would say, well, of course, your balance of payments is very, very poor with the United States now. And if we buy, $500 million worth of equipment, well, it's just going to be worse.
Yeah.
And I think often for this reason we tried to do some of these things in Canada. Now, we were successful on making all the new Army type vehicles, which was supplied to the Air Force, the replacement for the old Jeeps, 2.5 tonners, 3 tonners, etc.
Okay.
Well, we bought about 12,000 or more of these. And they're still being used today. But this was a simple thing.
Yeah.
I mean, our factories are used to turning out trucks, so. And indeed, parts of these, of course, were done. The harnesses, they're all waterproof. The ignition harnesses and things like that were all made in the States. Various parts were brought in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we were getting into far too sophisticated a business, especially when you consider the life of a fighter aircraft is short. If you think of the DC-3, the old Dakotas, we call it, when it was brought into service. Still running some of them in the Air Force. They may be all out now.
Mm-hmm.
But they started during the war. But look at the number of fighters.
Yeah.
And if you compare this with the number of transport types, they don't have to have combat characteristics.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Whether they go 20 miles an hour or more or less, it takes longer or shorter time to get there. You never have them fast enough in those days anyway to escape a fighter or anything like this. So I feel when you get into anything like a fighter, you're into something that goes becomes obsolete rapidly only because the enemy produces something, or a potential enemy produces something better. And therefore, it's extremely difficult for a country of our size to do it. And they will not have a big enough base to bring the price down.
There was, as I have in the next card, again about the arrow, a great many letters sent to Diefenbaker, and of course many of the letters that would be sent to Diefenbaker on defense, he would just turn them right over, and you see them, you know, in the Harkness and in the Perks papers, as well as the Perks about the, when the announcement finally came about the scrapping of the arrow. And some said that it was another example of Canada kowtowing to the United States. Some said it was a bloody shame that the large crew of crane specialists, etc., would have to be let go. Complaints from labor unions, town mayors, others with vested interest, etc. And another saying that the cancellation of the program looked as if the nation once more had to turn to the United States and rely on the U.S. for its sovereignty, despite election speeches at Diefenbaker.
I don't think these are very realistic. It's true. It's sad that we didn't succeed in this. It's sad that the United States didn't come and say, we will buy 2,000 of them or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we do? Do we go down and buy 2,000 planes to the United States? No. When we built the F-86s, we didn't pay in American dollars and buy them off the shelf in the United States. We arranged an agreement whereby we could produce them in Canada. And the F-104, the CF-100, they were produced in Canada, not the United States. Because we wanted to use our highly skilled workmen. And we could have got them, I wouldn't doubt, much cheaper and much more quickly if we'd bought them from the United States. They had a tool for them. But this doesn't keep Canadian highly skilled Canadian people working. And if we're going to, as we progress into the manufacturing age, you have to pay something, I imagine, from the public at large must pay a premium to get started in this business. And this is one. We picked one that was just a little beyond us. Not that we couldn't have built it, but beyond our ability to design, test, and prove it properly, and put it into production in time, and probably also at a reasonable price. It was an error in judgment.
And of course, the old Bullmark was looming up about this time, too. This seems to me that, you know, in these years, they've always impressed me as the period of the great changeover that comes about.
Bullmark was looming up, but we did buy. I think we're into our second, if not third, type of fighter since the Bullmark. We've got the Voodoo, the 104. These all came after the... Yes.
Yeah.
We have the F-86.
Yeah.
And then I think we went to the CF-100, the 104, and then the Voodoo. I've forgotten it's the one.
Yeah.
It was the last one that I know they were buying when I left in 67 or had delivered.
It seemed to me that I came across, I'm not sure if it's in here or not, some mention of the F-111, which is in... I'm no expert in the aircraft, but...
I'm not.
Yeah.
But I don't... of course, we have different numbers often from the United States, and that makes it difficult, too.
Yes, true enough. The next card I have here is on atomic warfare and the fear of. And I have, during the course of his career as Minister of Defense, Perks received a number of letters inquiring about or complaining about, first of all, the possible storage of nuclear weapons by Americans on Canadian bases.
Yes.
Now, of course, we have that. Second, the use of Canadian airspace by the U.S. Strategic Air Command aircraft carrying nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Overflights. Yeah.
Yes.
Inqu- inquiries came from various committees on peace and peace action groups and Voice of Women and God knows what else.
This is right.
As it was sometimes difficult, and it was sometimes difficult to know exactly how to answer.
Well, as I recall it, there were, as a matter of courtesy, I think Americans asked us if they could overfly with the atomic weapons, and permission was given to them for these overflights, and unless someone snooped around and found out about it, I don't think it was the custom to always acknowledge that there will be an overflight of so many B-52s going to Alaska or Thule, or no, we wouldn't be going to Alaska or something like this, with atomic weapons aboard. And these, of course, since we understood them, they were defused. They weren't fused at all. Chance of trouble was very small indeed. Mm-hmm. But if you're in an alliance with the people, remember, a lot of people forget that we have the Canada-US Regional Planning Group. It's one of the planning groups of NATO. And then we have another agreement with them, which is outside of NATO, for reasons I guess we both know, feel the same boat, the NORAD. The NORAD arrangement is outside of the NATO arrangement, more of a, the Canada-US Regional Group is only a bipartite regional group but as a substructure of NATO. The NORAD one is not a substructure of NATO. It's a Canada-US air defense plan for this country. Mm-hmm. So under either of these, it would seem logical and reasonable that military operations and exercises, military exercises and movements, which are not a hazard to the public, should be carried on, and people shouldn't shout and get excited about it. Mm-hmm. But we know perfectly well that the atomic bomb is a dirty word. It's an unfortunate thing that was ever invented, but there we are, we have to live with it. And you can't say to, I think it's stupid to say to your neighbor, you can't fly across our country.
Yeah.
Because they could fly up your coast anyway.
Yeah, so certainly just off the coast. I noticed here that there were 15 folders on this topic, on this fear of atomic warfare, and that they came from every conceivable group that one could possibly imagine.
Yes, they did. But then finally, when we got the Bomark, we got the warheads for them.
Yeah.
I presume they're stored
still
safely
there.
In Kamikaze and North Bay. And I don't think the population of North Bay has gone down. It's probably gone up. But it after a while, baiting about this wasn't quite as fashionable. It didn't get the headlines anymore, and therefore it sort of died off.
Now, I wonder, here again, it's just wandering off into the blue, to what extent all these veterans coming in, a great many to Perks, to Harkness, but also a very great many to written to the Prime Minister, how many of these he would have seen, or how many of these would have been kept out of his sight, I don't know, but surely there would have been enough to make him quite tender about the entire subject.
Now, do you mean Mr. Perks or?
No, Diefenbaker.
Oh, yes. Oh, of course there were. Of course. Because a lot of people address these things to the Prime Minister, mm-hmm. call him the Minister of Defense, because no matter what sort of man he is, once he becomes Minister of Defense, he's tainted by the military, and so they write to the Prime Minister if they want to deal at arm's length. And so I would think that the more important voices, if one could call them this, would probably feel that they may, since they're writing, they may as well write to the Prime Minister.
Yeah, write to number one.
And in all probability, he'll pass it on to his colleague, the Minister of National Defense. So I would think that a great deal of them. And it did concern the government greatly. I feel it was a political worry.
Well,
I don't think it was a real, honest-to-God worry of an educated man saying, Well, I wish so hard that there never should be an atomic bomb, therefore we'll never have one, and we just keep wishing, and therefore we won't have one in our soil or anything like this. Mm-hmm. I think they saw that if a country was to build up protective forces, that just, in my view, was nonsensical not to have weapons of this sort, and if they could have done it all very quietly, it would have been fine. And this thing came up very, very markedly when the Honest John was bought, but that's another story.
Yeah. And of course, there always seems to be quite a tendency on the part of certain Canadians, and I'm thinking more especially of Greens, who would love to, I sometimes think, burn every damn tank and sword and bayonet and
which green are you talking about?
External affairs. So that he could sort of stand up in the midst of the United Stations and say, look at us, we are pure, we are clean, why can't you be like this?
Yes.
And yet not saying a word about Canada actually being protected by the United States next door, that nobody dares lay a hand on us, or at least they would think five times before they did.
Well, I think it would be a very, if you have a mind like that, I suppose he sees it as a very enviable position.
Yeah.
First of all, you save $1.6 to $2 billion a year in defense expenditures, which is very nice. You look very Puritan, and you know that the Americans can't afford not to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hope that you still will have a voice, even if it's the voice crying in the wilderness in international affairs, and even though you contribute nothing at all to the defense of the West. Well, if you can believe this, fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hypocritical.
I find it hard to believe.
Here's another one. Again, this is just on the atomic weaponry. And it's a quotation from a newspaper article dated 5 August 1958. Written to Perks from a Mr. J.E. Price. And the clipping reads as follows. Washington, C.P. Canadian Defense Minister Perks flew here today from Ottawa for mutual defense talks. Amid unconfirmed reports, he plans to ask for atomic weapons for RCAF fighters flying with U.S. aircraft in joint continental defense. He was met at Washington in the military air transport terminal. And that's it. Perks immediately drove to the State Department for a talk with Acting Secretary of State Christian Herter. The first of a series of discussions he would have with U.S. officials during a two-day visit. Then he went to Colorado Springs, Colorado. And then in the later, on the 13th of August, which is a week later, signed by Perks as executive assistant, Robert said in part, it should be pointed out that the report contained in the newspaper article upon which you based your letter concerned the alleged intention of the minister to ask for atomic weapons for the RCF aircraft was subsequently denied not only by Secretary of State for External Affairs, but also by the news agency responsible for this article.
Well,
so this looks like a flash in the pan, actually.
But indeed, I don't remember, if you say, which was Velvet Glove, which was Sidewinder, which was this and that. I don't recall them because if it's not weaponry used yourself, you tend to forget the names. It was a few years ago. But quite clearly, at Chiefs of Staff and the Air Force, we're always talking about getting a air-to-air atomic weapon.
Well, this would have to be a weapon that would travel so damn far and fast ahead of where you're going. In other words, you aim and then go like hell somewhere else.
No, they're small. Well, they're very small. You see, the atomic shell finally got down, so you could put it in the 105.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much of size, although that certainly would come with an aircraft, but also the...
Well, this is a rocket. It's a guided rocket. You launch it, and away you go.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's guided onto its target.
Yeah.
There are two ways of guiding. There are several ways. I don't know which one's finally. You get your initial guidance in firing, and then it's acquired by ground control and guided onto the target, which is acquiring and following these enemy aircraft, and can be guided that way, or it can have its own guidance system by reflection from it.
Mm-hmm.
There are various types. But it seemed to me the obvious thing that if aircraft were coming in with atomic weapons to say we must only shoot at them with 20 millimeter cannon or air-to-air missiles with HE in them.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can put a VT fuse in it, which of course helps it, but you have to be much closer to the target to get a, your first round probability of kill falls off tremendously as the explosive effect. The first one you have to do is, it's like a roll gun, you have to pierce it, hit it, and the percussion on the cap set off the explosive. Well, that meant a direct hit. Well, the next thing you get is a VT fuse, and it will burst. If properly burst, it's all judged, it bursts within a distance that should damage the aircraft by fragmentation without having hit it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get the same thing exactly, except you put an atomic one in, you get a hell of a big bang, so you're going to take them out at quite a distance. So, this seemed a very logical business thing to have, and the hope, naturally, the hope was that the intercepts would be made over as uninhabited part of the country as possible. Now, dirty weapon as it is, unfortunate as it may be that you should burst some of these over your country, because they're bound to be some damage for them. I don't think a lot, but some. But what is the alternative? Let a bomber get through with his load of bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that brings up over the chances of the bears, the bisons, and so coming through. That's another, get into a long argument again, of whether what the probability would be of them getting through, or not getting through. They would get through quite easily if you didn't have the air defenses, but of them being used.
We have a lot of doves in Canada, I think, somehow. Let's see, here's another one on the...
Well, it's a technique at sometimes. The more you duck, the less you spend.
Yeah.
And that might be why. I think some of the doves are useful.
Here's one. This one I just put down was on the Avro aircraft, but that's it. We'll leave that for the present. One here on bilingualism. During the course of his career as Minister of Defense, Perks received a number of letters from various people and societies with respect to using signs in both English and French on buildings, correspondence, etc. When Harkness was Minister, in November 60, he was sent a booklet called Bilingualism of the Buildings of the Government of Office, Government at Ottawa, published by the Council on French Life in America. And there was constant harping by French Canadian societies, as well as many French Canadian individuals, to have the French language either written or spoken on every possible or conceivable occasion. Now this, as I say, is just sort of a sideline, and I remember what amuses me here, of course, is the fact that I remember interviewing Birch on something to do with bilingualism, and he said that if he had to be bilingual 50 years ago, he would never rise beyond the rank of private. But I was wondering to what extent, during your time, when you were there, there was a great deal of effort to get.
The first directive I recall on the subject was from Burke Claxton, when he asked us to be sure to wherever we got a letter from a French Canadian in French, and I'll go back to the word French Canadian in a minute, that we must answer in that language. The other thing, he said, you must not call them French Canadians.
whole French-speaking Canadians, would it?
French-speaking Canadians, uh-huh. Preferably just Canadians, but if you have to make a differentiation, it must be French-speaking Canadians, but never French-Canadian. Now they want to be called French. So, there we are. Well, then the point came up. Some person asked him, well, if you're writing to one of these people, isn't it all right to write in English? Well, he said, much better to write in French. So I intervened in this one, and there's two MP, and I said, well, I don't understand this. Was going to be writing in nothing but French then. I write to someone, am I to presume, because his name is so-and-so, that he doesn't read or write English, if I surely can initiate it in my own language. If he writes to me, and he'll probably reply in French. If he originates it in French, then I reply to him in French. Mm. But I can't. I said, I just don't see the thing. We're going into work in one language then.
Yeah.
And I think his remark was something, oh, well, damn it, use your head about it, but always reply to one, a Frenchman in French. Because
yeah.
He rather prided himself in speaking a bit of French.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
Did he?
He spoke it. I think his vocabulary was reasonably good. His pronunciation was shocking.
Mm-hmm.
But
how was your own been?
Terrible.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Very poor. I studied for years, but I didn't have a chance to use it at all.
Yeah.
And
was there any conscious effort on the part of the English-speaking officers, and they dominated, and I think they still dominate the armed forces today, to more or less make up for this by pushing up people like Allard and others?
I think there was a very definite point made of this, and I believe that many people, including myself, have often pushed some of these chaps a little faster because we felt so many in the service, and we have to show them that it's a good thing to be in and give them a push on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is very definitely done. We were encouraged as young officers to take interpreters' exams.
Mm-hmm.
You got so much more a month, I don't know,
yeah.
$3 or $5 or something a month. But it's strange that in my corps, the only one that I remember who got a first-class interpretership on the first try was Chris Sanford, who was an Oxford graduate. And the man who got on his second try, got a second class, was a French-Canadian. I think he failed the first time, got a second. Well, the reason was very simple, that he used the examinations that we wrote at that time and spoke at that time were handled by the British Army, not by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I remember one exam he failed in, and he was told you were an observer in an aircraft. You weren't part of the observer, and you were describing the various things, and talking about the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you had to use the French terms for it, not
mm-hmm.
the Canadian terms. And they had anglicized, I mean propeller, and you know, all these various
yeah.
things, and
I've heard the garage men in Ottawa do the same thing.
Yes, well, they crankshaft.
Yeah.
And this was the French that he was speaking would be well understood, and he'd be first class in an exam in Canada, presumably. But this was more of like the university type, you had to be right in it. I mean, you had to speak French without idiomatic expressions that wouldn't have normally been understood, say, by a person who had studied French in Germany or Sweden or someplace like this. There had to be, there's no such word, but you can call it French or an international French.
Yeah.
You'll find a person who has studied French in Holland or so, or Belgium, or those wonder languages. Except for perhaps a slight accent, it's the same as in France. The vocabulary is the same, and there aren't archaic words in it.
And then, of course, as minister, Perth certainly would never push French, as, shall we say, Cadieux would, in a later period. At least I can't imagine him doing that.
No, no, he didn't. And the Munsinger one.
Savigny.
Yeah, Pierre Savigny.
Yeah.
Well, he was an associate minister.
Mm-hmm.
But he was on administration, and there was no... He wasn't pushing French.
Yeah.
If he was, I wasn't aware of it at all.
Yeah.
So, but this is the thing. It was rather fascinating. I think I told you the story once, and I think if you're ever overseas, you can check it. This problem arose in the Belgian Air Force, because we're in Belgium, and I don't know the division between the Flamand and the Walloon.
Yeah.
And it became a problem. And if you are a pilot, or a ground controller, or an engineer, any of the skilled crafts in it, the language is English, not their dominant language, which is French, and their secondary language, Flemish. Well, what happened? Those who escaped from Belgium in the Air Force during the war went to England, as you know, and there were Belgian squadrons, or I don't know how many, in Belgian flyers, and they got into the more modern aircraft and all the techniques of ground control and everything else in English. Their manuals were in the, and so. Well, they found difficulty when they tried to do it in French and Flemish. That started a row, so they introduced English. And I had lunch at the Belgian embassy in Ottawa with, I've forgotten his name now, it wasn't Beale. It was one of the chaps I knew quite well from NATO days, Belgian, he was chief of the Air Force in Belgium at that time. And I asked him about this, and he said, that's right, we're still doing it. So that was probably 66, so their system was to take a third language, so that everyone in their Air Force knew what the hell they were talking about.
Yeah.
So we're doing the opposite. We're forming l'escadron. I forgot one of the new number, which was from Rivers, and moving into, and that language is going to be all French. So then, when you get your ground controllers, then they have to be bilingual.
Yeah.
Then when you get your air contact teams, if you are flying air cooperation, and you get your air contact team, which is very much like the Gunner OP or FOO, the Foo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he has to be biangular too, because it might be this water, it might be that one. So.
Oh boy. The next one is concerns the broadcast, and there's a number on there, but let me read, first of all, this one, which is a memo. From you requesting approval for initiation of procurement of first 700 Bobcats. It states that the Chiefs of Staff concur in this proposal. And you write as follows. In August 1956, the Cabinet Defense Committee authorized phase one of a two-phase development program for a family of light tracked vehicles. This phase was completed in September 58 at a cost of about $2 million. Phase two of development was authorized in 1959 at an estimated cost of $1.25 million, and has now progressed to the stage where success is generally assured, but additional funds and an extension of time for completion are necessary. With the successful completion of development now in sight, action should be taken to initiate the first steps of the commencement of production if the advantages of an orderly, uninterrupted transition from development to production are to be realized. The contractor is now able to reliably forecast that production drawings and specifications adequate for calling a firm price tenders will be available by 30 September 60. The Bobcat has been designed to give increased cross-country mobility and protection from blast, heat, and radiation from nuclear explosions. It will also provide a common chassis for an armored personnel carrier, 105 howitzer self-propelled cargo carrier, light reconnaissance tanks, and other roles. The Canadian Army regards the introduction of vehicles of this type as an essential step in its program of modernization, etc. The British and U.S. armies are developing vehicles similar to the APC version of the Bobcat, with other versions of the Bobcat being filled by development of other vehicles, that is, they are not based on a common chassis. UK vehicles are in an early stage of development, and it will be approximately 9 months before a prototype HPC is available.
I'm fresh now, Captain.
Yeah. The U.S. Army is arranging for the production of its APC version, which is the M113. The need of such vehicles has also been recognized by the armies of France, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, and Russia, etc. On the basis of tests and trials to date, it is probable that the Bobcat should meet successfully all our requirements, including the ability to swim. It will be air-portable in aircraft of the C-130B class or better, having nose or tail landings. Now,
loadings.
Yeah. Am I right? Did the Bobcat, was it ever produced?
No.
It never was.
Well, we produced enough of them, I've forgotten, for trial.
Mm-hmm.
We did swim across the Ottawa River in the spring when there's still ice in it with 105s and landed on the other shore and went our way. And did the things that reasonably, all the things we reasonably expected it to do. But again, this was one of the things we thought that Canada could do, but we were terribly slow, and we had the feeling that the companies who were doing the design, building the prototypes, didn't bring in from either the United States or Great Britain, preferably the United States, by paying a high salary, two or three more very good engineers who could do planning and production planning. This, we felt they were doing it more like they were doing an automobile, which they look back and last year and the year before and it builds up, but here they were starting something new and we felt they didn't put quite enough talent into it. At one time, I discussed abandoning the thing early. But this was opposed by Mr. Green. Part of the work was being done at that time at Fort William, Port Arthur, and I've forgotten, I think it was at Fort William, where the plant was. It was a plant that built the Oxford trainer during the war. And he was most unsympathetic to, well, our story at this time and discussions, I think it's in file, that we aren't getting enough money, we get so far, and then we have to wait, and we don't know exactly how much money a contractor, how far he can develop in a year. If he goes slowly, then we have money left over, but if he's really going well, then we have to come up for a supplementary and we don't get it. And that the American, which I think is now 119, they started with a 112 or 3, they were well behind, but they were coming on. And I said, unless we go faster, it's probably better to abandon this whole thing and place our orders in the United States, even though we prefer this common chassis to, they have a solution with a couple of chassis. Well, this was really frowned upon. I think it was agreed that it was something we must have. But there was great reluctance to abandon the program and buy American ones because the effect it would have on employment and industry in this country. As a matter of fact, if I had it to do over again with the knowledge I have now, my general feeling would be, and it was at one time when I started, but and I'd start again this when I came back as QMG, my idea was everything should be American. Well, I was dissuaded by the facts of life of this, but this is quite, if I was going through the error again, I would certainly feel that I should try to convince our people. They shouldn't even buy an FN rifle or a bloody thing. Buy it all American. And let them do. They pay for all the development work and whatnot. Get your manufacturing rights when you can. And we would be a dependent, completely dependent army. You wouldn't have highly technical.